From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our critic at large, John Powers, is back from the Cannes Film Festival, and we'll talk with him about what he's seen, what he liked, and what he didn't. This year's festival featured new films by Michael Moore, Gus Van Sant, the Coen brothers, and an already controversial Romanian film about a woman seeking an illegal abortion. Also, women in Iraq are increasingly the victims of kidnapping, rape, and honor killings. We talk with Inar Mohammed, who heads the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. The organization has set up a network of women's shelters and an underground railroad to protect women and help them escape their attackers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest today is a fellow Fresh Air contributor, John Powers, our critic at large. He's just back from the Cannes Film Festival, and is so enthusiastic about what he saw there, we thought we'd take the time to get a full debriefing. John Powers, welcome back to the States. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, glad to be here.
How good were the films this year?
They were great. It's interesting that this is the 60th anniversary, and I was there for the 50th. And when they had their big 50th anniversary, they had everything going except that the films weren't very good. You know, it wasn't their fault. You know, they had every star in the world come in. There were special fireworks programs and everything,
right.
And the films were lousy. This year, they had the stars, but this year, for some reason, the films were just extraordinarily good from top to bottom. You know, there are usually 20-odd films in competition. And what happens most of the time is people spend most of the festival saying, how did that film get into competition? You know, they'll say that of like 15 of the 20 films.
Mm-hmm.
This year, maybe people thought that of one or two. You know, that it was so strong that even the movies that you didn't like, you thought, well, that's actually a pretty interesting movie, even though I didn't like it.
And sometimes if you have good film years, you have bad judge years. What's your assessment of the judging panel that made the decisions on what films won things?
Okay, well, I think what's interesting to me about this is that I spend every year, probably like most people spend at the Oscars, saying, I can't believe that thing won.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that normally I just can't believe the jury of 9 people could be so wrong. This year, strangely enough, the jury chose almost everything that I liked, but not just that I liked, that almost everybody else liked. I mean, it's really an odd thing because normally there are all these weird agendas going on, you know, where something might be the best film, but in fact the jury has a lot of people from Europe and they want to make sure Europe wins.
Mm-hmm.
So that in fact the third or fourth best film wins because it's from Europe. This year they had a jury headed by Stephen Frears, the director, with 4 actresses on it, including Toni Collette and Sarah Polley. And one of the funny things about it, and this reveals something about the way film critics are, is that we were all faintly condescending but going into the festival about the fact there are going to be 4 actresses on the jury. And we all thought, you know, actors and actresses, like, they can't be trusted. Their judgment's terrible. But in fact, all these actresses brought up the best list I've ever seen.
Oh, wow. Well, the winner this year was a film from Romania, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. What's your assessment of that one?
It's a wonderful film. It's a really terrific film. And what's interesting about it is this is a film that nobody wanted to go to see. I mean, it was always described as the Romanian abortion film. And what it's about are 2 young college-age women arranging to get an abortion in the Romania of 1987 when abortion was illegal. And it sounds so dreary. I mean, the combination of illegal abortion and communist Romania is enough to scare off almost anybody. But the story proceeds like a combination of social drama, horror film, and thriller. And as you follow these 2 women, in particular the friend of the woman getting the abortion, the action is unbelievably exciting and incredibly revealing about what it was like in the days when people actually had to go to fly-by-night people to get abortions. And as you're watching it, the film is almost perfectly turned. It has a superb lead performance by an actress named Anna Maria Marinka, who's just splendidly good at conveying what it's like helping your friend get her abortion, even as the friend is passively, aggressively selling you out in all sorts of small ways. And what's interesting about the film is that it's not really about abortion, but more about how the process of getting the abortion changes the life of the woman who helps her friend.
Wow. And so I guess the title, 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, is the term of the pregnancy to this point.
Yes, it's the term of the pregnancy, which actually makes it rather late, which is actually one of the complications in the story, and which is one reason why I think this film will probably be very controversial when it plays in the United States. And it will play in the United States because it won Cannes and is a good film. But in fact, there's no question here about the morality of the procedure. The whole thing is just about how they go about doing it and how it affects them. And I can imagine that there's going to be a lot of controversy from the anti-abortion forces when this film comes out, because, in fact, it's very tough and not at all sentimental about what it means to abort someone in the 4th month. In fact, it's rather grisly and nasty, and the film shows you that. So, that, in fact, I can imagine people being really interested by this film and there being lots of debates around it.
Was anything else that politically sensitive?
There's been a huge sea change. You know, 2 or 3 years ago at Cannes, all the discussion had to do with Iraq And it was kind of obligatory for people to bash the United States for being at war in Iraq. You know, now that the war has gone badly enough that Europe is kind of forgetting about it, they're more obsessed with their own problems. I mean, one of the touchstones of this was that although Michael Moore's film was hugely successful, he wasn't as big a deal this time. He was there with his film Sicko, which is his film about America's health system. And it was rapturously received, but this was a case where it was only about America, whereas when he was there with Fahrenheit 9/11, which actually won the festival, he was treated as a kind of god. You know, because here was an American saying how awful America is, and Europeans were eating that up. Whereas here, they just liked the movie.
But in this movie, didn't he do, wasn't he comparing different nations' types of health care and being positive to France? And I would think that would play fairly well. In France.
Oh, no, that's one reason why the Europeans loved it was that it actually did suggest that their social services are better than America's. But in fact, it wasn't really so much of an America-bashing movie as sort of a sad-about-America movie. And what's very smart about the movie, and I think it's his best movie,
really?
Is that Michael Moore does two things that are very smart. The first thing he does is he says, this isn't a film about people who don't have any insurance. It's about people who think they're covered. So the first thing he's doing is saying, this isn't just about poor people. This is about everybody who thinks they have a health system.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second thing he does is he says, let's take seriously the idea of actually having a state-run health insurance company. Once you do that, let's look at the things people have said about national health insurance as a criticism. And so what he does is he takes the various things you might object to. Oh, you don't get very good care. Or that, in fact, the doctors have to go broke to do it. And then he goes to different countries. He goes to Canada and to Great Britain and to France and deals with each of these issues and basically goes and asks patients, how do they feel their care is? You know, he goes to doctors and says, do you feel poor? And then you go to the doctor's house where he lives in this huge estate and he's actually making $1 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, no, he doesn't feel poor, but he wouldn't want to be on a system like ours, where the health care is determined by financial organizations like insurance companies. It's a very smart movie in that way, extremely entertaining. And, you know, to my delight, he's not in it very much.
I know what you mean by that, even without it being an insult to Michael Moore.
Oh, it is. Well, I mean, it's partly an insult to Michael Moore. You know, and, you know, one of the funny things about the Michael Moore image around the world is that if you're in Europe, they think, and you hear people say, well, they really let Michael Moore show this movie. And, you know, if you're an American, you're thinking, I see Michael Moore every 2 minutes. You know, this is the least suppressed guy in the history of the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's kind of nice to see a lower key thing that isn't particularly a Bush bashing movie. You know, it doesn't feel cheap. You know, there's one bad section, I think, where he goes to Cuba to make the point that the Cuban healthcare system is actually fairer and in some ways better than the American healthcare system, which might be a reasonable point, except he has some idealized photos of grinning Cubans, kind of like he had the grinning Iraqis during Saddam's period in Fahrenheit 9/11. I think he just can't help himself in doing that. That kind of left-wing habit just dies hard. There's that little bit of propaganda in it.
So it's Cuban propaganda that he's doing for Cuba?
You know, he takes a very funny idea, which is to say, here are some people who were injured during 9/11 or cleaning up after 9/11, and they can't get care. The first thing he does is he says, I'm going to take them to the Guantanamo prison because, in fact, the health care system for the Al-Qaeda suspects is better.
Oh.
And he very wittily tries to get them in so they can get the same health care as the Al-Qaeda suspects, which is a very clever thing to do. But they, you know, the government won't let them in, so they go to Cuba, and that's when he starts talking about the Cuban health care system. And what seems to be a reasonable point at first, you know, it just gets sentimental and has too many grinning Cubans, and it seems all a little too beatific. You know, politically, I think it's a mistake because it will allow his enemies to say he's idealizing Cuba. And in fact, that's only a very small part of the movie. I think almost anybody who has health care would be interested in this movie because it really is extraordinarily touching and scary, because the whole point is no matter how much you think you have, the health care system can get you.
How do you think it's going to do in the States? I mean, if he's the most popular nonfiction filmmaker, do you think that he's going to be able to top himself at the box office?
I don't know whether Sicko can beat Fahrenheit 9/11 just because the war unleashed all sorts of feelings. I think it'll be a huge hit. It's an extremely entertaining movie. And I think it'll probably turn out to be an important movie as you head into next year's election. And part of what will make it important is that it doesn't seem nearly so much to be a Democratic film as the last one did. I mean, the last one was so clearly an attack on the Bush administration, whereas here, both parties are rather guilty of letting our health system get to the state that it's in, that I think it will actually have a broader audience than the last one. And as I say, it's extremely funny and quite touching.
Okay. Another thing that's high profile over here in terms of the movies is the one starring Angelina Jolie as Marianne Pearl, who was the widow of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. How did that go over, and what was your opinion of it?
It went over surprisingly well. I somehow had a sense that people thought it was going to be a real bomb because it's once again, it's one of those films that you're not really sure you want to see. You know, do I want to see the film about the wife of a reporter who was beheaded by monsters? And, you know, the answer is, you know, on the face of it, I don't want to see it. But when I got there, it actually gripped me and held me all the way through. I mean, the interesting thing about it is that even though it's about Marianne Pearl, she's the center of the film, and Angelina Jolie is playing her, but most of the film is more like a Michael Mann movie. It's a very procedural guy film as they're following how Daniel Pearl got grabbed and then trying to capture the people who caught him. So that actually Marianne Pearl is more off to the side than you think she's going to be. You know, meanwhile, she kind of strolls through the movie a bit like a movie star in the sense that because her husband has been grabbed, no one dares say no to her. And that, in fact, that you know she's treated with kid gloves through the entire thing. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think, the kind of role that Angelina Jolie would know how to play. And she certainly goes for it. I mean, I think the one problem is that I personally find Angelina Jolie's so vast a screen presence, which is distinct from, say, being an actress, that it's very hard to see her playing somebody you know as a real person. Because even when she's acting well, she's just so Angelina Jolie that, you know, you feel like she should be on Mount Olympus rather than in some apartment someplace. I mean, I think it's, for me, that's the most interesting thing about her career is, like, how do you find roles that seem big enough for her? Because, I mean, somehow she just pops on the screen. When she's there, she just, you're watching her and nothing else.
John Powers, our critic at large. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with John Powers, our critic at large, who just returned from the Cannes Film Festival. When we left off, we were talking about some of the new American films. There's some really exciting names, and the little word that has trickled back is very puzzling. The Coen brothers have done a film that sounds darker than what they've done before. Gus Van Sant has one that sounds beautiful, and Quentin Tarantino sounds like he didn't impress anybody. What can you tell us about those films?
Well, I think the great joke for Americans was watching the Tarantino film, which had been very well reviewed in the United States, just be hated by the Europeans. You know, they thought it was completely worthless. You know, why would a person make a film like this? It's just girls talking in a car chase. They didn't like it at all. You know, and you know, so it's actually kind of funny because normally Tarantino is the god of Cannes, and this year people were just saying he's all over. He's crazy. This is worthless. But the films they liked were, as you say, the Coen brothers film. And it, the Coen brothers film, which is a good film, it's an adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's novel called No Country for Old Men. And it basically follows the story of a guy who finds some money. He's played by Josh Brolin, who then is being pursued by a genuinely terrifying psychopathic killer, played by Javier Bardem, who is in turn being pursued by Woody Harrelson and Tommy Lee Jones.
Wow.
And it's a superb cast, And it features some sequences so exciting that not only was my heart pounding as I watched it, I actually had a nightmare about it when I went to bed that night. And, you know, Javier Bardem, who didn't win Best Actor at the festival when he should have, has come up with probably the scariest psycho killer, you know, in a long, long time. I mean, it's so spooky. It's not like, and it's not like Hannibal Lecter, who's sort of a psychopathic relief serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you put him in the movie, it's supposed to be sort of fun. Whereas Bardem's sort of fun, but he's genuinely disturbingly evil. And, you know, his weight really sticks with you. And the film is about partly the persistence of evil and good people trying to deal with the fact that evil is powerful and persistent and almost in a dark kind of way, demonic. And so the film, you know, has a force and a seriousness that their other films don't have.
It sounds like you liked it a lot.
I liked it better than any Coen film I've ever seen. You know, I'm not a huge fan of theirs, so it must be said that some people who like their other things, you know, don't like it so much. But I think on the whole, it was one of the two best-received films at the festival, the other one being 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. I mean, it was very highly received, and I think the reason it didn't win anything probably had to do more with the jury deciding it was going to reward the things that didn't start off with famous American directors and big movie stars. That's actually what I think probably happened.
Okay, and what about Gus Van Sant's Paranoid Park?
Yes, well, Gus Van Sant's film is almost the direct antithesis of it. It's small, elliptical, extremely beautiful, almost avant-garde, and it tells the simplest imaginable story. It's about a young guy who likes to go skateboarding in this slightly dodgy park, skateboarding area known as Paranoid Park. And one evening he gets involved with a couple older guys and he accidentally winds up killing somebody. And it is quite accidental. And that's the whole story. And what it's about is trying to capture the interior life of this young guy and what he dreams of, because he's not very articulate or very expressive. So we keep getting images that are actually going through his head of what he thinks of as being exciting or transcendent. And at the same time, we get a sense of the social world in which he lives, in particular a world where there is no such thing as adult guidance. You know, so that as he shows the kids with their parents, you never see a parent standing there intact as an actor. They're always either out of focus or you only see part of their bodies. It's a very delicate, subtle thing. You know, it's in some sense probably the smallest miniature at the festival. You know, and this is at a festival, you know, where lots of countries like Japan specialize in miniatures. But I think the Van Sant movie is this pure mood piece, and it's extraordinarily ephemeral and delicate. I mean, when they showed the first screening, the projector broke, and there was a break in it. And you could actually feel the air go out because, in fact, it kind of transports you in a hypnotic way.
Uh-huh.
And you realize that this is one of those movies that's so delicate that it's really hard on it to actually have a break of even 30 seconds. Because it just pulls you along on gossamer wings.
Now, I know that when that film was brought to the festival, it didn't even have a distributor. Has that changed?
Yes. Yes. The Van Sant film now does have a distributor, I think, and will be coming out, I believe, this fall.
Oh, good.
You know, it will be in lots of other festivals. What's interesting, actually, when you talk about distribution, is that one of the frustrating things about Cannes in some years is that you'll see very good films and you'll think, well, that one will never play in America. Whereas this year, almost all the things that are good will get distribution because they're enough better, they have something going for them, and that everybody was excited about them. So virtually everything got picked up that was good, which is a really exciting thing, because one of the things that I get to do that many Americans don't get to do is see what's going on out in the world in movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, I mean, you know, we're living in a time when we're told that the outside world matters more to us than ever before. Yet, strangely, in some ways, it's harder to have movies come to your theater that are from outside the United States. And so it's actually a great thing when a festival like Cannes is so strong that maybe 15 of the competition films come over. And they are coming from South Korea or Russia, or they're the little Gus Van Sant film that is such a delicate mood piece that, you know, sometimes it might not get released at all.
Were there any trends this year that you noticed?
Well, there were two big trends. The first of them was the triumph of women. and it must be said that this has to be put in the context of the fact that Cannes is traditionally a boys' club. You know, there's only been one woman who's ever won Cannes. And this year, for their 60th anniversary, they were asking international filmmakers to do three-minute films for a compilation called Each to His Own Cinema. And of the 35 people who did them, one was a woman. And it was the same woman who'd won Cannes, Jane Campion. Okay. So starting from that, the way the festival actually turned out is that a huge number of the most important films of the festival were women-dominated. 4 months, 3 years, and 2 days was a great women's film. Marjane Satrapi's animated feature called Persepolis, about a young woman growing up in Iran, you know, won a prize, was supremely good. You know, it will be a big hit here in the United States, I think, as well, because it's just a great story. There was a South Korean film, and the actress in it won the Best Actress Prize, about a woman whose child is kidnapped and how she deals with her grief. And it's this lacerating performance, this just an amazingly great performance. You know, and all the way through the festival, the most interesting things seem to either be by women, starring women, or somehow to do with women, which was very interesting because, as I say, Cannes is not famous for that.
John Powers, our critic at large. He just returned from the Cannes Film Festival, where he saw more than 30 movies. We'll talk more with John in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Histories of Herodotus, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In Iraq, women have been killed for not wearing a veil. Coming up, we talk with Inar Mohammed, founder of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, about her efforts to protect Iraqi women. She herself has received death threats and must work in secret. And we continue our conversation with John Powers about the Cannes Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Our critic at large, John Powers, just got back from France, where he attended the Cannes Film Festival, and says that this year's festival was the best he's ever attended. Let's get back to his remarks about what he saw and what we can hope to see soon. Was there anything else that you noticed, whether it was a coincidence or a trend that was building in the movies you saw this year?
Yes. Well, I think the other big thing that's happening is, I guess, some sort of idea of globalization in cinema. Because it's really interesting how many films either had to do with people crossing borders or were themselves films in which people crossed borders. So one of the most interesting films I saw was a film set in Paris made by this great Taiwanese director named Ho Hsiao-hsien. And his film is set in Paris and is about Parisians. And in fact, it turned out to be a really, really good film. Similarly, the opening night film called My Blueberry Nights, which many people were disappointed by, is by the Hong Kong director Wong Kar-wai, who made 2046 and a bunch of others. He's a huge international favorite. This was his first film in English, and it was made in America and takes place in New York and Memphis and Las Vegas. And then you have, and in film after film, you would see this process that either the films are about people crossing borders or people crossing borders to make the films. And you realize, oh, that actually is the great story of our time, is people crossing over borders to do things. You know, that, you know, I remember Salman Rushdie writing years ago that immigration was the great story of the 20th century. And it seems to me now to be an even greater story in all sorts of interesting ways.
So do you think that those films will touch certain nerves in the U.S. because it's such a hot topic here right now?
Well, I think actually what's nice about the films is that they make immigration seem appealing and they show you the good things that come from there being immigration. You know, to get back to the film called Persepolis, which I've mentioned earlier, what's so fascinating to me about it is it's a film that celebrates France eventually because the heroine of it, you know, grows up in Tehran and eventually winds up in France, and it's only in France that she finds freedom. By finding her freedom in France, she then makes probably the best film by any French person in the festival, even though she's Iranian.
Because we're talking about politics in film and stuff like that. When that was shown at Cannes, was there a sense of how it might be received back in its home country? Was there any of the sense of the stuff that has just happened recently where the country of Iran has basically denounced the film and denounced, you know, the woman who made it? Or was none of that even entered internationally at the festival?
No, we all knew that the Iranian government was going to hate the film. And in fact, we knew it so much that it was actually built into some of the questions that were asked of its creator, Marjane Satrapi. I remember one critic said, "Are you worried that this film, in its depiction of Iran, will actually help the Bush administration in demonizing Iran in order to go to war?" And she said, "Not at all. The Iranian people are great people. You know, there are issues with the government, but in fact, if you watch the film, you realize that the Iranian people are a good, big-hearted people and that, you know, they're having problems, but in fact, it's a great culture." And in fact, the film does show that, but at the same time, we all knew that the Iranian government wouldn't like the way the country was depicted, or in particular, the way that fundamentalist Islam was depicted by the film.
So this is sort of like filmmakers saying, "We're citizens, or we are looking at citizens of these various countries, and don't judge us necessarily by our leaders."
Yes. What Satrapi does think is that you should never judge any country by the policies of the government until you know more about it. And the film is so loving in its portrayal of ordinary Iranian people that I do think that when you watch it, you will think, "Oh, yes, they're a lot like us," rather than, "These are demons who must be destroyed."
And finally, we've spent this whole time talking about movies that you liked. Did you see anything that you really didn't like?
Yes. The worst film of the competition, and of the entire festival for me, was an American film called We Own the Night by this guy named James Gray, who the Cannes people, I think of as their discovery. And it's basically the most routine cop brother movie imaginable. You know, Joaquin Phoenix plays a guy who's involved in bad business. Mark Wahlberg plays his honorable cop brother. And then eventually the bad brother becomes the good brother and the two of them fight the Russian mafia. And it is so riddled with stupidity and cliches that the American and English audience or English press couldn't wait for it to end so we could all get up and boo, which in fact we did.
The great joke of these, you boo at these screenings?
Oh, of course. You know, part of the fun of it is that unlike real life where people are restrained, here people boo or hiss or applaud wildly. You know, or sometimes they do one of the most famous things at Cannes is there are certain seats that really pop up hard. So if someone's offended by something, you hear this thwack and you realize that somebody is very prominently walking out of the screening. So we were booing the James Gray film, and it was a lot of fun to boo. And as we, as we left, you could overhear that the French and Italian critics were kind of liking it, and that they thought it was really good. The same people who had disliked Quentin Tarantino's film Half of Grindhouse and thought it was vacuous loved this movie and thought it was pure cinema and a masterpiece. And we were all flabbergasted. And I remember saying to somebody that it made me proud to be an American, because in America we knew that this movie was no good, whereas in France they actually thought it was a work of brilliance. And so it was just bad in the kind of ways that every TV cop show in America is bad.
Hey, not every TV cop show.
No, actually the example I would give, because I'm a great fan of some TV cop shows, is that you would think that The Wire had never existed watching this show, because it's so riddled with good cop, bad cop cliches, evil mobsters with no dimension whatsoever, family cops with no dimension whatsoever, that you think, this is a film from 1935 that's been transposed to the present day but made with less good technique.
Hey, thanks for doing this. This is, I think, the first time on Fresh Air that, even though I'm guest hosting, that it's like two of us as critics have gotten to sort of bat the ball back and forth. I had a good time.
No, so did I. Thanks for having me.
John Powers, our critic at large. He just returned from the Cannes Film Festival. Coming up, Iraqi women's rights activist Anar Mohammed. This is Fresh Air. Anar Mohammed has taken great personal risk to run a women's rights organization in Iraq. She was raised in Iraq but left in 1993. She moved to Canada with her son and husband and worked as an architect and sculptor. After the fall of Baghdad in 2003, Mohammed heard from a friend about new problems and issues facing Iraqi women. She returned to the country and co-founded the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq. Mohammed criticizes the war, which she says has cost Iraqi women their freedom and legal rights. Her outspokenness and activities on behalf of Iraqi women have earned her both acclaim and numerous death threats. Terry Gross spoke to Mohammed earlier this month while she was in the U.S.
Anar Mohammed, welcome to Fresh Air. The invasion of Iraq was supposed to be helpful for women's rights in Iraq. How have women's rights been affected by the invasion and occupation?
When we speak about women's rights, there are many parts of it. There's the legislation on one side, but the side of it which all of us women feel and live on daily basis is the way you go to work, when you come back home, how you're being treated inside your home, and also the streets, whether they are women-friendly or not. Since the invasion in 2003, March 2003, it was only a few months before we started to receive horrifying news that women are being kidnapped on the streets.
What are the kidnappings about?
There were different reports, but mostly it was young women who were kidnapped to be sexually exploited for a few days and then thrown on the side of the street. And the sad part of the story is that when some of those women tried to go back to their houses, to their families, a good number of them were killed by their families because the whole issue was considered honorless. It has smeared the honor of the family, and it was, scary to hear that first you can be kidnapped in the street by strangers who want to exploit you sexually. And why would they do that? Just simply because they can. There is no police, there is no government, nobody to stop them. And at that time, there was a big number of criminals that have left the prisons, so they were free to do whatever they wanted in the streets. The ousting of the regime involves too many kinds of chaotic issues where we find out that women are the most vulnerable to. So in those days in Baghdad, walking in the streets was very dangerous. You could be targeted just because you were a woman.
And is that still going on now, the kidnappings?
The kidnappings go up and down because the situation is changing drastically, and the reasons for the kidnappings have been changing. For some time, like in the first 2 years, the industry of trafficking of women had risen to numbers that were unprecedented in Iraq or unknown even. The numbers were in thousands. So at that time, it was in order to sell these women in sexual markets inside and outside Iraq. But later on, in this last year, we heard that a good number of kidnappings were in order to ask ransom from the rich families in order to give them back their daughters. And sadly, some of those families would say, we don't want them anymore because we don't know what you have done with them. So that's the honor killing mentality. Mm-hmm. And the third part of the story, in the last, I would say, 4 to 5 months, we heard in some of the Baghdad suburbs that sometimes the many females in one family are kidnapped at once, detained or assaulted. And that's also a new story. And when we asked into the details, it turned out that what is similar to a death squad.
So are women being attacked by sectarian groups now?
At this moment, yes. A big number of women were attacked for sectarian reasons. Their houses, their families get attacked first, the men get detained, and when the house is empty of the males, these militias that are affiliates of the police and the Islamist Shiite militias, they go into the houses. We received many reports that after the men were detained, the women were attacked in the houses, assaulted, and in many instances raped. A few of them were killed later on not to leave any witnesses of the crime taking place. And in many situations, we hear that they were also kidnapped and sold.
Can you dress as you please on the streets of Baghdad now?
This was a question to be asked last year or the year before. I would have answered you, no, I cannot dress anymore in the way that I please. I cannot show my hair. I cannot walk around in the jeans and the t-shirt that I was used to wearing in Baghdad all my life. But this year, the situation is much tougher. It's not just the veil that you have to wear. It is the kind of veil that is the trademark of the Islamist militia that is prevailing in your neighborhood or in your district. That is, in the Shiite districts, you have to be veiled in black from top to bottom in a way that could show your face. But in some of the areas under the Sadr groups, the women have to go further than that. They have to wear black gloves and black stockings so as not to show any part of their skin. While you go to the Sunni, the areas, the districts dominated by the Sunni Islamist militias, and those are, to make it clear here, most of those are affiliates of Al-Qaeda organization. In those areas, the women have to wear multi layers of clothes. They are not black usually. And you have, not a single part of your skin can show, but the hands do not have gloves on them, and there is a part of your face that can show. So it's your veil is the flag that they use on their districts to tell the enemies, this is our power zone. Dare not come into it. And your dress code is just the tool for that. But who is the woman inside that veil? Nobody cares.
How is this enforced?
It happened gradually. last year in the one of the suburbs in Baghdad, Shiite suburbs in Baghdad, it's called Chaib area, they began to hang, not posters, flyers on the wall saying that the women, first, the veil is the beauty of the women, and second, that you are not allowed to wear high sandals. You should not wear high sandals. You should not show your hair. And they give you details of what to wear and what not to wear. First, they publicize it. Second, they tell you that you do not look decent. You should not be coming like this, looking like this next day. And then they just start to force it on you, and beatings have become a regular matter in this issue. And in some of the areas, districts controlled by the Sunni Islamist militias, killing was very regular. We heard many reports of women killed in the Salman Pak area because they were not veiled. And sadly enough, some of the Christian women or the Mandai women who are not Muslim, and like in their faith there is no such thing as veiling, and it was imposed on them, and a few of them threatened or a few of them killed because they did not wear the veil.
As president of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, are you now forced to work underground?
Actually, our women's shelters, we locate them in secret places, and we change those locations from time to time because the women that we keep in there are wanted for honor killing, and if anybody finds out their places, it's killing not just for them but also for us. But the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, our headquarters in Baghdad, the address is known to everybody, and we get a good number of visitors on daily basis. And it's part of our mission, let's say, in Iraq, to go open about challenging the misogynist and telling them our doors are open if they want to come in and debate with us. We have been open in our locations, but I don't want to give the wrong impression. We do not feel very secure. We have a few guards around us, and I try not to be there for very long periods because I expect that I would be targeted, and my being there for long periods could be jeopardizing the other activists.
I know you oppose the invasion of Iraq right from the start. But have the U.S. troops in Iraq been of any help to you in your work as a women's activist?
On the day which I received the death threat that told me that I will be killed, I was going to be killed in a few days, I knocked their doors and I told them, just like you are providing facilities and some help for the tribal heads, the ethnic heads, the religious heads, you give them cars, bodyguards, and ways to protect themselves, I need the same. On that day, the answer to me was, and it wasn't directly from the official, he said it to his assistant, the assistant said it to a soldier, the soldier said it to the information man in the front gate, and they told me, oh, you are not the only one targeted. We cannot give protection to everybody who knocks our doors. So what kind of support did I get from them? Nothing.
What kind of protection do you have?
With the few funds that we get from our supporters, I am able to get a bodyguard, one bodyguard that stays with me most of the time, and some guards for the organization. What can that do in front of a police squad that could invade our organization at any point they feel like it? Nothing. That's the security that we have now.
Anar Mohammed speaking to Terry Gross earlier this month. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Anar Mohammed, president of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq.
Are you getting the support of women in Iraq? Do women want the rights back that they've lost? And even if they do, are they afraid to say that?
You know, sometimes when I make a protest demonstration or speak over the television, some people try to tell me, oh, who do you represent? Just yourself. Well, you know, some of them try to keep the world under the impression that women of Iraq do not want freedom, do not want to live better off, do not want to have higher self-esteem. But who are they kidding? Who likes to be slapped around at home? And who would like to watch their husband marry another wife and just to shut up and watch? You know, I have received, I would say with no exaggeration during these years, hundreds of telephone calls, emails, and some visits in my organization telling me that, Yanar, you were the only one who spoke of our daily sufferings. We do not dare to say them in front of our husbands or our brothers. And this means a lot.
Something that's been very confusing about Iraq is, on the one hand, the new constitution has an article that says that Iraqis are equal before the law without discrimination due to sex. But at the same time, the constitution also says that no law can be passed that contradicts the established rulings of Islam. So, what takes precedent there? Do women have equal rights, or are women subjected to Sharia, which is Islamic law, which does not give women equal rights?
The Sharia will be the base foundation for legislation in Iraq. So they have imposed on us that Islamic Sharia prevails, and anything in discrepancy with Islamic Sharia will not be allowed. Islamic Sharia allows a woman, a female, to be married at 9-year-old. Islamic Sharia allows multiple wives for one man. Islamic Sharia gives all the rights to men for divorce and for custody. So you cannot go against those. And we have now an Article 41 in the Constitution that says women can choose their family law, whether to be dominated by the Islamic Sharia or to be referring to the previous personal code in the country. But tell me, if you are a woman surrounded by a big number of misogynist males in your tribe and you go to a court, can you tell them, I do not want the Islamic Sharia to rule my family life? Like, who are they kidding? They have left millions of women in Iraq vulnerable to their religious laws.
Do you know men in Iraq who seem to be perfectly comfortable with women's rights and the equality of women, and who now seem perfectly comfortable denying women those rights? In other words, are you surprised at how some of the men you know have changed as the situation has changed in Iraq?
Well, the important part of the story is that women's rights is a political issue. And the political wave that runs in the country, that affects a lot of what the society's tendency is like, and especially the prevailing class, because they have all the media, they write the rules, and they show tremendous number of religious shows from day to night to all the males of the country, some of whom happen to be opportunists and want to have seats in the government, and for them it's more convenient to choose those norms where, first, by choosing them, they are respected more by the prevailing class, which is the Islamists that are ruling now. And second, for them, it's more comfortable at home because they are being served by women who have been turned into servants inside their houses. So do I know of a number of men who have turned from progressive to reactionary inside Iraq? I would tell you yes, a lot. The prevailing politics, they affect a big number of people who are not really keen on human rights or do not have the access to the outer world or to the developed world where things are different for women, or have a very determined agenda of keeping the women equal to men. But then again, on the other hand, you have a good number of progressive men, and some of them are members of our organization, and they do help us push the women's issue very much ahead.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Inar Mohammed, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this month. Mohammed is the co-founder and president of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq. She's featured in an article in the current issue of Ms. Magazine. You can find a link to the article on our website at freshair.npr.org, where you can also listen to the show and download a podcast. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from the Criterion Collection, offering a continuing series of classic and contemporary films on DVD, available at Criterion.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at MOMA.org. And from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Knocked Up is the latest film by Judd Apatow, who also wrote and directed The 40-Year-Old Virgin. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Judd Apatow and with actor Seth Rogen, who stars in the new comedy. He plays a young slacker who becomes a father after a one-night stand. Join us for the next Fresh Air.